You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 12th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hello.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello.
Oh. Jay Novella.
Hello.
Evan Bernstein.
I can't even try to top that, so I'll just let that be.
Okay. I hate you all.
And joining us as a special guest rogue this week, Massimo Piliucci.
Hello there.
Or Massimo, as we like to call him.
Massimo.
Massimo, you have a unique distinction on
all
this
right.
podcast. In that...
Just one.
If we hearken back to June 7th, 2005, episode Whoa. Number 3, you were our first interview on the
oh,
show.
Oh, cool.
I was pretty young that time.
Yeah. Weren't we all?
It was 5 years ago, yeah.
Rebecca wasn't even born yet.
Hey.
Steve, isn't unique distinction redundant? I'm just saying.
No.
He's just saying it before hundreds of listeners have the chance to say it.
I was going
to
say, that's for the listeners to decide.
So, Massimo, part of the reason why you're joining us at this time is because you have a new book coming out called Nonsense on Stilts. And I believe you said the release date will be May 15th, which is the day this podcast goes up, correct?
How did you know the book was coming out? Oh, I told you. Right. Yes.
You told me. You said, please have me on your show so I can plug my book.
That's exactly right. Yes, it's May 15, although from what I hear, it is already available actually on Amazon and people have been ordering it.
What's it about?
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, you know, the phrase nonsense on stilts is actually an old one. It goes back to philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who used it to indicate things that he thought were outrageously idiotic or stupid. And so there was just not just nonsense, but really, really tall nonsense, you know, nonsense walking on stilts. In particular, however, the book is about the complexity of the landscape that separates science from non-science, from pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. As you guys know, that's in philosophy, that's known as the demarcation problem.
Right.
Karl Popper thought he had a very, very easy answer to what distinguishes science from pseudoscience. If a hypothesis or a statement is falsifiable, then it's science, it's scientific. If it's not falsifiable, then it's not scientific. Turns out that was a little bit too simple. And so the book explores the idea that, in fact, there is a continuum between things that are definitely and clearly pseudoscience, let's say astrology or intelligent design, things that are clearly and definitely science, let's say, you know, fundamental physics or evolutionary biology, and then the really interesting stuff that is in between, which we don't know what to make of, or it's hard to make up our mind about whether it's science or to what extent it is science and not.
Give me an example of something you think is right in the middle.
Well, for instance, right at the moment, string theory would be right in the middle, meaning that it's a fundamental, it's a theory in fundamental physics, which is supposed to address a major problem in physics, which is the apparent contradictions in some realms of application between quantum mechanics and general relativity. Now, those are two of arguably the best established theories in science. It's hard to imagine that either one of them is wrong, let alone both. And yet, when applied to certain problems, such as what happens inside black holes or the very origin of the universe, they tend to give us very different answers. So string theory is one of several attempts that physicists have made over the last three decades or so to reconcile quantum mechanics and general relativity. And as it turns out, it's a beautifully developed mathematical theory. It's the mathematical constructions, which I don't even pretend to understand, are in fact, I'm told, very nice, very interesting, and very convoluted, except for the little detail that so far, at least, there is no way to test empirically any of the claims of string theory. So string theory is compatible with everything we know about physics, but it hasn't made any predictions so far that are empirically testable, which raises the question, well, if something no matter how beautiful it is. But if something does not make any empirically testable predictions, is it really science?
And yeah, we've had this discussion before with Michio Kaku, and I've heard other physicists discuss it. And this is something about which theoretical physicists can disagree. The problem that I heard was not so much that it doesn't make any predictions, that it makes too many predictions. There are so many different formulations of string theory that even if you disproved one of them, there's 1,000 others lined up ready to go. So it can't be constrained in such a way that it can't be falsified.
Right. To some extent, actually, they're both true. At the moment, at least, the theory in any form doesn't make any predictions outside of what's already known. In other words, it makes a lot of postdictions. Right. Right. So it explains a lot of things that we already know, but that's true also of other theories in physics, such as the standard model. It is also true that string theory comes in hundreds and hundreds of different forms, in fact, possibly thousands of different forms. So it's really a family of theories. And there doesn't seem to be any way, even in principle, that no matter how good we get in the near future at providing new data, gathering new data in fundamental physics, it doesn't seem possible or conceivable that we would be able ever to discriminate between hundreds or thousands of different versions of the same theory.
Right.
So that seems to be a big problem. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily, of course, that string theory is wrong in any particular sense. In fact, one of the books that famously criticizes the theory, which is by Peter Voigt, who is a mathematician and physicist, it's entitled Not Even Wrong.
Yeah. Right.
Meaning that we don't know.
Yeah, with not even wrong, essentially suggesting that it's not even a scientific theory.
Right.
You have to be scientific in order to be wrong.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, Brian Greene, I heard a talk by him, and he said that it's really not accurate to call it a theory. He refers to it more of a hypothesis.
Yeah, that gets into the interesting, I was going to use the word sophistry, but perhaps that's a little unfair. I mean, it gets to the difference, what is the difference between a theory and a hypothesis? Now, in philosophy of science, a theory is a general broad construct, such as quantum mechanics, for instance. And a hypothesis is a specific kinds of, either a subset of a theory or a specific type of predictions that are made from that theory. So if Green wants to consider string theory a hypothesis, in that sense, that would mean that it's not as comprehensive and not as much as the ultimate theory of everything that it's supposed to be. But I don't think that's what he meant. I think he meant that's just a conjecture. It's just something that is in the workings. And that's right. That's fair, except that, as another critic of science of string theory pointed out recently, Lee Smolin, who wrote a book entitled The Trouble with Physics, string theory has been a working hypothesis for about 3 decades. And the question at this point is fair to ask, how much longer is it going to be working before it actually produces results that are,
right.
Seriously empirically testable?
Right, but I think the counter to that is it's just really hard. So what if it takes 100 years? That doesn't mean it's not science. It just means that this is intractable given our current state of science. And we may need to wait for further advances before we can really even know if it will pan out as a scientific theory.
Fair enough. Yes, you never know. Never say never in science, right? You can never say, well, this is definitely the wrong way to go, because then the following week some smart aleck publishes a paper in Nature and shows that you're wrong.
Right.
Correct. So that's a good point. But the point that Smolin is making, for instance, in his book, I find it interesting, and it really deals more with the sociology of science, not as much with the philosophy of science. And the point is this. String theory has been so successful as an academic endeavor that so many people are absolutely convinced that the theory is so beautiful that it really ought to be true, which, incidentally, it's an interesting criterion because it's an aesthetic criterion for science.
From elegance.
That's right, the argument from elegance, right?
Yeah.
Which carries a lot of weight with physicists in particular, even though actually the history of science shows that a lot of beautiful physical theories have actually been disproved. But never mind that. The thing is, string theory has been so successful as an academic endeavor that for many, many years, pretty much anybody who wanted to have a serious career in fundamental physics had to be a string theorist. Most of the positions, faculty positions, were devoted to hiring string theorists. Most of the grant money that was given by, for instance, the National Science Foundation was going to string theory. So a fair question is to say, okay, well, yes, it may take you 100 years, you know, maybe it's a little too early to reach a conclusion, but how about we spread out our bets and we fund other approaches, which
absolutely.
Are
absolutely.
Yeah, that seems perfectly reasonable. I think we should probably tell our listeners at this time who you are. Now, you've been on our show before, but for those who don't recall, you are actually a professor of philosophy, right, at City University of New York.
As of last year, yes.
Yes. And you are the author of the Rationally Speaking blog. I think you have other guest bloggers there, too, but you're the primary one writing for that blog, and also one of the hosts with Julia Galef of the Rationally Speaking podcast.
That's right? Correct.
Which is the official podcast of the New York City Skeptics.
Yes, and we're having a lot of fun doing it, and pretty soon we're going to have all of you as guests, one at a time.
One at a time, okay.
Promises.
I've been listening to it. It's great. I think you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you.
Well, let's go on to some other news items, and we're going to actually be coming back to this point on the demarcation problem a little bit later when we talk about Sam Harris. But first, let's get through some other news items. Did you guys hear that the Oxford English Dictionary was wrong, had the wrong definition of the word siphon in it for the last 100 years?
I'm outraged.
Oh. Yeah.
Non-Cromulent definition.
How stupid are they?
Down with this sort of thing.
And
who dug deep and found this one, Steve?
And even worse, pretty much every dictionary consulted copied the Oxford English Dictionary. So this mistake was basically copied over and over again through most dictionaries. It was discovered by Dr. Stephen Hughes, a physics lecturer at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane. And you know, the term siphon refers to the notion of, you know, siphoning off or sucking off fluid from one body to another, or just like draining some body of water by, you put a tube in there, you get the suction going, and then once it starts going, it will continue to go. Now, the definition of how it works in the OED and in most dictionaries was that it was differences in air pressure. That if you hold the end of the tube below that you want the water to drain to, below the end that's stuck in the body of water, differences in pressure will push the water, the fluid along, and cause the drainage, which is simply not true. And
differences in atmospheric pressure.
Yeah. But there is no difference in atmospheric pressure at such a short distance, so it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, actually, when I was in grade school, I learned how siphons worked, and I didn't realize the dictionaries had it incorrect. It's actually just due to gravity. You know, once you get the fluid going, if you have, you know, one end lower than the other, gravity, that's the force that's at work causing the fluid to flow through the tube, and then it's that creates suction, right? Because if the water flowed down the tube but nothing came in to fill it, that would cause a partial or total vacuum in its wake. So, you know, gravity is the initiating force, and then...
Initiating?
Well, gravity is the force that moves the water down.
Right, right.
And then...
Right.
Sucking.
Yeah, and then the resistance to the creation of a vacuum that then draws the water up to continue the process, right? So...
And the reason why I clarified atmospheric... that it's not atmospheric pressure, as that's what's in the dictionary, is because it is hydrostatic pressure.
Hydrostatic,
yes.
Right.
So it is a kind of pressure. It's just not atmospheric.
It's not atmospheric, right? But the OED had atmospheric pressure in as the explanation.
Right. One guy had a great example how, because some people, still a lot of people are saying, well, it's a combination of pressure and gravity, because you got to create some pressure differential to get it going, and then gravity takes over. And one guy said, all you really need to do is put that tube in the water that's at a higher elevation, fill it with water, put a stopper in it, and then take that stopper, you know, take the end with the stopper, bring it down to the lower container, remove the stopper, bam, you've got your siphon going.
That's
with
right.
No sucking, you know, no sucking needed, you know, to get it started.
That's
that
right.
Was a great example of how you can get it going, and showing that it's purely gravity.
Now,
it seems.
where atmospheric pressure comes in is when you're sucking something up against the gravitational gradient, right? So if you're drinking milk out of a straw, you suck at the high end of the straw that's in your mouth, right? And that
otherwise it'd be rather wet.
It would be. That creates a vacuum or a partial vacuum. And there what's pushing the milk up the straw is the atmospheric pressure pushing down on the surface of the milk, which is greater than the pressure inside the straw because you've just created a partial vacuum. Now, there are those who argue that the same thing is at work, the same principle is at work in getting the water to go up the segment of the siphon before it gets over the top and then gravity pulls it down. And that is actually a legitimate point. So it seems, you know, in reading about this, that there are a number of explanations for what the real driving force is in a siphon, and that can include, there is at least one contribution to atmospheric pressure, although not the difference between the two ends of the tube, the difference in pressure inside the tube. That pressure gradient goes towards the lower end of the tube, and that causes the water to flow. And that is contributed to by the atmospheric pressure on the surface of the water. Now, there are those who claim that a siphon will work in a vacuum, although I was unable to find any empirical evidence of that, and several people pointed out that in a perfect vacuum, a liquid would evaporate very quickly, and therefore they're not really sure how you could test that. But still, there are others who say that the primary force is the tension between the water molecules, that you could treat water like a long piece of string or a chain that's connected, so that when one end flows down, it pulls the rest of the chain up. It's pulling the rest of the water up. So here's one way to resolve which of the two forces is more important. Atmospheric pressure has a limit. It could only, you know, one atmosphere can only push water up a gravitational gradient about 10 meters or 30 or so feet, 34 feet. It turns out that you can't siphon something, you know, greater than 10 meters up. If you have a reasonably sized tube and you try to siphon, if the uphill component of that siphon, even if the other end goes below it, if the uphill component is greater than 10 meters, it won't work. Unless you have a really thin tube. If you have a really thin tube, you can get higher than 10 meters because that it's thin enough that the cohesion, the tensile strength between the water molecules is enough that even when you're getting into essentially negative pressures, you can get higher than that than what the force of atmospheric pressure can get to. So actually, I think in the final analysis, there's still a little bit of controversy about this, and there are contributions from both atmospheric pressure and water tension, with gravity being the driving force on the downhill gradient, but what's drawing the water up is a combination of atmospheric pressure and water tension.
This is so much more easier to grasp than string theory.
A bit.
So it appears, but don't you think that the real story here is that it took 100 years to figure this out, to find the error?
Exactly. I agree. I mean, this is kind of like a high school science kind of mistake or misconception, but the interesting thing is that it was not discovered for 100 years, partly, I think, because everyone was content to copy the world's authority on the English language, the Oxford English Dictionary,
and
that
well,
gives
yeah,
them authority.
Because everybody who knows what a siphon is doesn't need to look it up in the dictionary.
Right.
Everybody who doesn't know.
Yeah,
doesn't
but how
know.
Many times did eyes yeah, pass over point. That? Right. Like how many people over the past 100 years had to read that and then you know republish it in another book? A lot of people looked at that. And it just got looked over for 100 years.
Yeah. And it's a dictionary too, not an encyclopedia. So the people who are editing it aren't scientists; they're
right.
editors. They're specialists in the English language.
But it's still interesting that this thing has been copied so many times, right? Because yes, the Oxford, of course, is supposed to be a source, or, you know, authoritative source. But that's the point. When you write something, you know, like a new dictionary, you're not supposed to just trust somebody else's sources, no matter how good those sources are supposed to be. So I find this interesting, and I don't think this is limited to dictionaries. I think a lot of stuff, I see a lot of textbooks in science that just copy freely examples and figures and everything, tables from each other. And then it takes somebody to take a look and say, oh, no, wait a minute, that figure is wrong. And it turns out it has been wrong for, you know, many years across many different textbooks.
That's exactly right. In fact, I remember reading an essay by Stephen Jay Gould in which he did a little investigation. He found that some majority of science textbooks were using the same very specific examples, which could really only be explained by just outright copying. For example, they compared the size of a Hierocotherium, the first horse, to that of a terrier, the dog. Why would that particular breed? There's no particular reason why you would choose that breed as a comparison. But he found like 80% of the textbooks used that same example. They must have just copied it forward and copied it forward. So that's a real problem. It's just really laziness, you know. Let's go on, Bob. You're going to tell us about Neanderthal DNA.
Yes, I will. It now seems clear that apparently that modern humans, being the lascivious monkeys that we are, interbred with Neanderthals 50 or 60,000 years ago. And we know this not because of some ancient cave painting porn, but because most of us actually have Neanderthal genes in our very DNA.
I was hoping for the ancient cave painting porn myself.
No, still looking for that.
that.
For the record, Neanderthal and Neanderthal are both accepted pronunciations, so please don't send emails on that. So this landmark scientific achievement was recently announced after a four-year effort by scientists at the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and universities around the entire world. Now, the fact that they could reconstitute 60% of the genome from people that were dead tens of thousands of years is amazing, if you want to call them people, which I think is appropriate.
Sure.
They did this by first grinding pieces of bone from three separate Neanderthal individuals. And then you have this bone dust, and then you kind of have to wade through all the modern DNA that contaminated it just from handling, and all the bacterial DNA, I'm sure, that was in there as well. And just to find this Neanderthal DNA, so that was quite a tour de force just to get to that point. Fortunately, ancient DNA chemically degrades in a predictable way, and that allows this software that they've developed to detect it and correct for it. So that's how they were able to put all this together. They then compared this Neanderthal DNA to modern European, Asian, French, and Papua New Guinean DNA. And finally, they compared the DNA also, and most importantly, to Western and Southern Africa, individuals from Western and Southern Africa. And they found that 1 to 4% of the Neanderthal DNA was part of all this DNA except the African DNA. So everybody that was European or Asian or French or from Papua New Guinea, they all had a little bit of Neanderthal DNA except the Africans. Now, the most likely interpretation of this data that makes sense is that that after modern humans left Africa, part of the out of Africa hypothesis or theory, but before they could really separate and colonize the world, they interbred with Neanderthals 60 to about 80,000 years ago, somewhere within there, probably in the Mideast, mixing in their DNA, which we can now see in probably billions of people. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the idea. You had an outflow of humans, of modern humans, leaving Africa, but before they could essentially colonize the planet, they interbred with Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And, which is why...
I bet it was mostly the French that did it.
You think so?
Unfortunately, the French didn't even
what
exist
call?
Back then. But
what
now,
call?
Oh, man, that was good.
Nicely done,
right.
Evan.
So I can't think of any other interpretation.
Yeah, I can't either. It just seems
like
Bob,
a natural
conclusion. Yeah.
So that means that we were close enough to them genetically that we could breed with them.
Oh, sure. I mean,
that's actually an interesting point. Some people, I'm sure, will say, well, how could two species mate and produce fertile young? Well, actually, this is interesting. The designation of Neanderthals has gone back and forth over the years. For decades, for the first 50 years after their discovery, or the first 50 years of the last century, you know, most scientists consider them to be completely separate species, which is kind of a fuzzy concept anyway, but they call them Homo Neanderthalensis. But lately, in the past few decades, scientists have been kind of thinking that they're more of a subspecies of Homo sapiens, and they call them Homo sapiens neanderthalensis. So my guess is that this latest research will solidify them as more of a subspecies to us rather than a separate species.
Or, it's more accurate to say that we're both subspecies, not that they are a subspecies of us.
Right, which is true, because if they were around before we were, then maybe we should call ourselves Homo neanderthalensis sapiens, maybe we're a subspecies of them. And just the term subspecies, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, that's more of a race, right? Kind of just like another race of humans.
It blends seamlessly one into the other.
Right.
It's all very, very fuzzy. The difference between a population versus a race versus a subspecies versus a species is a continuum.
It might be closer to think of it as a breed. Because like a dog breed is different. The difference between dog breeds is substantially more different than the difference between human races.
But they're still the same species,
It really depends on which definition of species one takes. There are several in biology. The one we've been implicitly referring to is what is called the so-called biological species concept, which is this idea that if you interbreed, then you're part and you produce a fertile offspring. Then you're part of the same species. If not, you don't. But that concept of species is actually quite fuzzy, and it applies differently to different groups of organisms. I mean, to give you an extreme example, in a lot of plant species and even in some vertebrates, there is quite a bit of intercrossing between so-called species. Just think of orchids, for instance. So just because things can interbreed, organisms can interbreed, that doesn't mean that they necessarily belong to the same species. As far as races versus populations versus subspecies are concerned, that also depends really on who you ask in terms of what view of systematic biology they take. As far as humans are concerned, races are really an extremely fuzzy concept that has almost no biological grounding, because there's been a lot of interbreeding within Homo sapiens, and so there's almost nothing that you can really say meaningfully about it from a biological perspective, not culturally, obviously, about races. There certainly are no subspecies of humans at the moment, because a subspecies, most biology think of a subspecies as an incipient species, as a species that is about, as a population that is about to form a separate species. That may have been what the Neanderthals were, close enough to be a different species, but not quite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I think even when you have two species that have clearly separated, they have separate populations that are different enough, either geographically or culturally, behaviorally, whatever, that they are mostly not interbreeding, and they're definitely on their way to becoming completely separated species. For a while, they will still occasionally exchange DNA. If you remember, a couple years ago, there was the news item that analysis showed that at about a million years after chimps. The split between humans and chimps, they were still swapping some DNA back and forth. So I think that's the same situation with sapiens.
Because you're young, Rebecca.
I mean, it always surprised me that, Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthals could live for tens of thousands of years in Europe together and not be occasionally shacking up. I mean, that is just human nature, if you will. And so this makes more sense to me. No comment. Well, let's go on to the next item, which is also...
Something just occurred to me.
Wait, let me pull the horse out so you could beat it to death a little further. Okay, go ahead.
No, this is interesting. They say 1-4% of the genome, but I assume that the similarities that they found were protein encoding parts of the genome, right?
I don't know.
It's not junk DNA they're talking about.
Who knows?
Not necessarily. I think this is a genome-wide search.
Yeah,
so
but
it may not be. It may not be just protein coding.
It is relevant, because if it's protein encoding, then it would be a much greater percentage of the protein encoding part of the genome as opposed to the entire genome wide. Do you know what I mean?
It'd be a higher percentage of our genes.
Yes,
that's my only point. Yeah,
that's my only point.
That's correct, but I don't know what the answer is. Let's go on to the next news item. Have you guys seen the Alabama political ad?
It felt like puking.
Yes.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Disgusted. Well, the tone in the voice of that was...
Bradley Byrne was a Democrat.
Now he's a Republican.
On the school board, Byrne supported teaching evolution, said evolution best explains the origin of life, even recently said the Bible is only partially true.
Candidate Byrne changed his tune.
Legislator Byrne voted to raise...
That's pretty terrible. I just, before we begin this, I'm going to put out a request that we not use any Southern accents in mocking this.
Oh, we can't use Southern accents?
Really? That was my whole bit.
I know, Jay.
Wait, only if Massimo does it, because he's already got an accent.
That's right. And besides, I lived 9 years in Tennessee, so I think I have rights there.
You're fine.
Oh, that's right.
Some of your best friends
are close enough.
Right. So you know, Bradley Byrne, again, obviously is a candidate, Republican, for the Republican nomination for governor of Alabama. So this is a primary race just among Republicans. And his opponent is essentially accusing him of believing in evolution and of thinking that the Bible's only partially true. Those are the accusations that are being made against him. Now, Byrne was so outraged by this that he has responded saying that it's not true, that he, in fact, has supported teaching creationism in our school textbooks.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah.
And he says, I believe the Bible is the word of God and that every single word of it is true. So
every single word.
Yeah.
Right. So this says something about the state of the Republican Party in Alabama specifically, and I think more generally in the southern region of the United States. And I do think this is a bit of a change. I think in the past, candidates would, you know, certainly be open about their religion, but wouldn't make as a matter of pride their rejection of evolution. I think they would tend to be more coy about that. Now it's really it's an open matter of pride in the election that they reject evolution and promote the unconstitutional teaching of creationism in textbooks. I mean, he's not even reverting to, you know, any kind of academic freedom thing. He's flat out saying teaching creationism in textbooks, which, what was it, in 30 years ago that the Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional?
Yeah, it's not just the ignorance that is so upsetting with this, but it's the celebration of the ignorance.
Yeah.
It's the crowing about the ignorance that really makes it difficult to deal with. And of course, the fact that these are men who want to be in positions of power. It's quite disturbing.
What office is he going for?
Governor
of the state. Yep. Got to appeal to your constituency.
Yes, but do remember the spectacle of the Republican presidential candidates last turnaround, where they were raising their hands if they
Huckabee,
believe in evolution.
Yep.
And, you know, Huckabee was right there. And, you know, now it's true that he didn't go on to win the nomination, but boy, that was pretty scary.
Yeah, although it was only, what was it, 3 out of 10 or something? It was the minority, but there were definitely a few, you know, Southern candidates who that was their position. Yep.
Hey, at least they're honest. I mean, right?
Well, not necessarily, actually, because that's the other thing, that it's not clear. I mean, some of these people, I'm sure, are honest and they really do believe this crap. But it's not really clear, because a lot of these people actually pander to whatever they think is going to get them elected. And so
that's right.
I'm not so sure that yeah, exactly. How shocking is that, right? So we don't even know if they actually believe it. Not that really believe creationism is a particular, you know, badge of honor. But at least, I guess, if you're coherent with your beliefs, that's better than not.
One of the a few of the commenters on the videos said, I was seriously hoping this was from The Onion. I thought that was perfect, because this is exactly the kind of thing you can read in The Onion. You know, just that one notch beyond reality, satirical kind of thing. But now reality is sort of caught up with the satire. This really is indistinguishable from the kind of thing The Onion would run.
You know, sadly, we come across that a lot in skepticism.
Yeah.
More often, I think, more average.
Oh, yeah, you can't make up
consumers of information.
You can't make up the stuff out. You know, nothing as good as the stuff that's already out there.
That's what a Poe is, P-O-E. It's anything that...
Edgar Allan?
When you first read it, you can't tell if it's satire or... Mm. if it's real, because the two have blended at this point.
Right. The next item, Massimo, I know you've actually written about as well. Sam Harris has written a very interesting article in the Huffington Post, of all places, called The Science of Morality. And this has been a debate that's been going back and forth in the blogosphere about, essentially the question is, can you have a science of morality? Or is morality something that is simply outside of the epistemological limits of science? So, Massimo, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think that Sam Harris wrote a lot of interesting things in that in those articles. Actually, he posted more than one thing. He posted on his blog as well as, of course, on the Huffington Post. And I also watched the TED lecture that he gave. There's a lot of interesting things, and in fact, I tend to agree with most of his points, except with his most fundamental one, which is, no, I don't think science by itself can answer ethical questions. And in fact, his own examples are, I think, are clearly point that way, and I don't understand why it doesn't seem to see the problem. But let me sort of summarize briefly what he's saying. So he's suggesting that, look, moral facts are just a particular type of empirical facts. There are certain things that we can tell empirically make people, say, happy or not happy, that cause pain or pleasure, that make people flourish or not flourish, depending, you know, regardless of what your particular definition of flourishing, of course, happens to be. And he says, if that's the case, then we can do a science on morality in the sense that science can empirically tell us what things are going to work in a certain way for human beings and what things don't work. So what kind of societal structures and societal rules or rules of behavior are going to have what consequences. That is absolutely true, meaning that, of course, we can tell empirically what are the consequences of human actions, behaviors, and societal structures and rules. But that doesn't tell us anything about whether those rules or actions are right or wrong. In order to say, to make the equation, which Harris does make, between, say, for instance, flourishing and right and not flourishing and wrong, well, you already have to start out with a particular ethical theory of, in particular, virtue ethics, which says that, you know, the right thing to do is what increases human flourishing. But that is only one way of looking at ethics. There are other ethical theories, and it seems to me that Harris started out with a particular commitment, you know, particular philosophical commitment, which apparently he didn't even realize. And then from there, yes, it does follow that once you made that commitment, science can inform a lot our ethical decisions.
But what do you think about his point? I think he addresses that, where he says that may be true of ethics, but it's also true of any other science you can care to mention, that you start with some first principles, and you can challenge those first principles the same way you could challenge any first principles that you're using as a basis for an ethical system as well.
You mean you can empirically challenge
them. Or even philosophically, like for the specific example he says is, if you're a physicist, you say, well, then that therefore physics, you know, is science because it's empirical, etc. And he says, yes, but who says that empiricism should be the starting point? You're making a philosophical assumption there as well.
Right. That's definitely the case, and it's an interesting case because of course the commitment to empiricism or the commitment to scientific realism, all of those are philosophical positions. They're not scientific, and they can certainly not be explored within science. You have to make those commitments first, and then you're going to do one type of science or another, or you're going to look at scientific theories in one way or another. So that's definitely true. But the thing with ethics is that no philosopher, modern philosopher that I know of, would disagree that it works in a similar way, meaning that there is a separation between your ethical commitments on the one hand and the empirical information that you can use to inform specific decisions.
Right.
So in that sense, he's not breaking any new ground. I mean, again, it seems to me that he's unaware of a large philosophical literature in ethics. No modern ethicist that I know of actually disagrees that science has nothing to say about our ethical choices or the consequences of ethical choices. In fact, quite a bit of research recently in ethics deals with, it's done within an area of philosophy that sounds almost oxymoronic. It's called experimental philosophy, which, you know, most people think of experiment and philosophy as far apart as possible. But as it turns out, a lot of philosophers have been engaging scientists and working together. You know, the typical example, which I think it's a beautiful set of examples that have come out in the last few years, are cognitive science studies of the so-called trolley problems. So the trolley problems are a classic thought experiment in ethics. And these are situations like the following. And actually, I'd like to run the trolley problems experiment with you guys. So I'd like to know what you think about this. So imagine that there are, this situation, that you're walking down the street and you see a trolley, you know, going on out of control because whatever, the brakes are not functioning or something. And you see that it's about to hit five people who are unaware of it. They can't move. They're going to die. Now, you have the possibility, the option of pulling a lever and putting the trolley on a different track. If you do that, however, you're going to kill one innocent bystander. The first question is, what would you do it?
You do it, yeah.
I guess I would do it. Yeah.
You have to do it.
The net
thing there is four lives.
Right. Okay, good. Most people would agree with you guys that in this version of the trolley dilemma, yes, you pull the lever and you save five people, you kill one, they're all innocent anyway, so you have a net saving of four lives. Great. Now imagine the second variation of the dilemma. Same exact situation, the trolley is going down, is about to kill five people. You don't have a lever at this point. What you have is a large man standing next to you on a bridge, and you have to actually push the man down so that he can block the trolley and stop it before it's going to kill the others. Would you do it now?
Aha! See, now you're getting tricky.
Yes.
That's
the
whole point.
Did you not think it's going to get tricky at some point?
It can't all be easy.
Well, I mean, you know, logic dictates that you do the same thing. Yeah, you do. You sacrifice the guy. But then there's the emotional aspect of it, which, you know, my first gut reaction was, well, then I'm a murderer, you know, because I'm actually
– right.
It's different. Yeah, okay.
It is different. Great. Okay.
I would like to think that I would be able to do it, even though that there's a personal loss here for me.
Right.
What if I threw myself? What if you throw yourself down?
That's the funny thing. These are thought experiments. So the thought experimenter, in this case myself, controls completely the experiment. No, you can't throw yourself. You can't yell. The people are not listening to you. Those are the conditions of the experiment. Now, what you guys just said.
Well, Massimo, wait. What if I could throw Sarah Palin instead of the guy?
Now that you mention it, that's a different issue. But anyway,
okay, we'll talk about that later.
So the interesting thing is this: if you actually do the experiment, if you get together with a group of social scientists and you in fact do the survey, it turns out that most people react exactly the way you guys have reacted. That is, in the first version of the dilemma, most people agree that yep, you really have to pull the lever, and in the second version, most people say, no, whoa, wait a minute, now I'm actually directly killing somebody, you know, personally being involved in this thing, and I'm not so sure that it's the right thing to do. Now, more recently, neurobiologists got into the act, and they showed that different parts of the brain are activated when you think about the two different areas of the two different kinds of the dilemma.
Cool.
When you're talking about the first version, the lever version, it turns out that most of your response comes out of, you know, the frontal lobe area, the cognitive, rational thinking areas of the brain. But when you're talking about the second version of the dilemma, the
limbic,
yes, the push the guy in front of the trolley, then it turns out that the amygdalas and areas that are in charge are associated with emotional responses are turned on, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so what have we done so far? We learned a lot about how human beings make moral decisions, right? The neurobiology, we learned something about the neurobiology of it. We learned something about the sociology and psychology of it. All of this is very relevant. It still doesn't tell you, however, whether it's right or wrong to pull the lever one way or the other, yes? Now, you guys said, even when we started out, we all said, because I would agree with that, that in the first case, you have to pull the lever. But even that kind of apparently obvious and logical decision actually implies a particular type of ethical commitment that is of a philosophical nature. We're essentially all consequentialists here, or utilitarians. Mm-hmm. That's the type of philosophy that would ethics that would bring you to answer in that way. But there are other ways of looking at the problem. I mean, there are other systems of ethics. For instance, a deontological system, which is a system based on rules. Like, you know, the classic example would be the Ten Commandments. It's a deontological system of ethics. Well, some of those systems will say, no, no, it's always wrong to actively cause the death of anybody. And so they're both in the first and the second case. You're actually wrong in interfering with the system. Other systems of ethics, like virtue ethics, which I usually tend to be sympathetic to, this goes back all the way to Aristotle, would probably strike a compromise, and it would say, well, actually, the your actions depend on the you have to really pay careful attention to the particular situation, and it does make a difference whether you're actually actively or passively interfering with the situation, so that in the first case it's okay to interfere, in the second one is not. All of this has nothing to do with the science. Mm-hmm. All of this has to do with whatever kind of philosophical commitment you have made to ethical issues, to ethical problems.
I agree with you, and I think that... Let me get back to Sam Harris's essay a little bit and tell you where I agree and where I disagree with him. First of all, you know, as you point out, he makes a point of saying that he hasn't read the philosophy of ethics. He hasn't read, you know, ethical philosophers because he doesn't want to get caught up in their jargon and their way of thinking, because that will impede his ability to communicate this to the public. And I don't buy that. You kind of lost me there, because I think that you do need to understand what the people who are spending their careers thinking about this are saying.
Yeah, we hear that same sort of sentence from the mouths of every free energy person on the planet.
Right.
You know, and to me it's very disrespectful of people who do this for a living. It's saying, you know, you guys are too embedded that you can't see the forest for the trees, and I'm going to come in and I'm going to blow your minds. And it's, yeah, I just find it really disrespectful. Do the work.
Yeah, and just don't let it bias you.
Right. I took that that kind of statement as, unfortunately, an example of intellectual arrogance on the part of a scientist, which is really too bad.
Yeah.
You know, imagine what would happen if a philosopher were to say, you know what, I just don't buy this quantum mechanical stuff, and I haven't bothered reading the technical literature because I don't want to be biased, but, you know, I just don't think that this is right, and
yeah,
I got
exactly.
my own theory. I mean, that, come on.
Exactly.
Nobody would take that seriously.
Now, where I think he has a reasonable point is he says that, you know, a lot of the criticisms of sort of a science-based system of ethics is the notion that there is like this demarcation problem, and that there are difficulties with, as you say, with definition. And his point is that you run into the same problems with, let's say, medicine or psychology or psychiatry. That, you know, for example, here's his very specific example. You may have difficulty defining well-being as your basis for an ethical system, but
right.
you also have the same problem defining health as a basis for a medical system or medical science, which I agree with. The two definitions are fuzzy, and he is right, but I think he draws the wrong inference from that. He says, therefore, a system of ethics is just as scientific as medicine is, but I think what he's missing is that medicine is not an entirely scientific endeavor. It is mostly scientific, but when we do get into issues of, like, what is the definition of health, we also run into personal and philosophical issues that are not answered by the science. The science only gets you so far, and then you have to make a personal decision with the patient about what they value.
Exactly.
And what they value may be different. So his analogy was correct, but he actually drew the wrong inference from it because he has a misconception about what medicine is.
Right. But so you're using his analogy and essentially undermining his point.
Exactly. And what I came away from is the notion that he was essentially laboring under this false dichotomy that either you have a science-based system of ethics or you have moral relativism. And
right.
I think that there is something in between. You could also look at this, as I think you were getting at, Massimo, there's sort of the scientist's way of looking at this and the philosopher's way of looking at this. And my position would be, well, it's both. This is sort of a quasi-scientific philosophical endeavor where you can use a system of logic based extrapolating from first principles. It could be informed by a lot of scientific information about the evolutionary underpinnings, or at least the neuroscience and underpinnings of our moral thinking and statistical consequences of the actions that we take, etc. But at the end of the day, there's going to be some kind of subjective value judgment. And we further have to recognize, which he also acknowledges, but then I think draws the wrong inference, that different people make different moral judgments.
Right.
You know, the science may explain why some people make one value judgment and other people hold another. Maybe there is a genetic neuroscientific explanation for that.
Perhaps.
But it doesn't matter. But it doesn't even matter.
No, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right. But I want to make a couple of comments about what you just said.
Sure.
First of all, this idea that there is a continuity between ethics and therefore philosophy on the one hand and science on the other. Yes, absolutely. I wrote a technical paper a few years ago published in a journal called Zygon, which is a journal about ethics and philosophy and ethics, which was entitled precisely The Continuity Between Ethics and Science. And this is a fairly well accepted point, as I said earlier on, by philosophers. But what we're seeing here in Harry's attempt is the attempt to discard an entire tradition of thought, an entire way of doing things, and just say, you know, we got the answer because we got the empirical evidence. It's a very simplistic approach. Now, the second point is, you're right. I got the exact same sense that Harris is really fighting against moral relativism. But the funny thing there, again, is that he's got very powerful allies within the philosophical community to fight against relativism, and he just doesn't seem to be aware of it. There is an entire area of ethics which is called meta-ethics, and it's about the justification for ethical systems. You know, how do we justify, how do we know about what is right and what is wrong, and how do we come up with these sort of decisions in ethics? And most meta-ethicists are definitely not moral relativists. And there are very, very good reasons for why you don't want to be a moral relativist. But again, these are reasons of value and they work within the logic of ethical systems. They're not necessarily empirical reasons. So it seems like Harris could have been much more productive in sort of reaching out and say, look, why don't we get together? We have science has a lot to contribute to these issues. Philosophy obviously has a lot to contribute to these issues. So getting together, we build something that is really interesting. But of course, that would be not exactly the kind of headline grabbing thing that has generated all this discussion.
I don't think he's grabbing for headlines. I think he honestly believes what he's saying. I think what's really driving him is this recoil from moral relativism, which he equates also with postmodernism, and I agree that there's a relationship there. But you can and then he says he's come to the conclusion that the only way to get rid of moral relativism and postmodernism in this context is the science of ethics, of science of morality, and to basically expunge philosophy from it, or to say that it plays no more of a role than it does in any other science, which I disagree with. So I think that's where his core mistake was. And he kind of, I think he gives away his motivation at the end of the essay, where he basically says, he brings it back to religion, saying that religion is used as an excuse for moral relativism. And the examples he gives throughout the essay of moral relativism about, say, female genital mutilation, for example, or wearing burqas, he says that he finds it amusing when philosophers try to justify these sort of things as on the basis of moral relativism.
Right, but I don't understand who is he talking about, because I don't know of any philosopher that is actually trying to justify genital mutilation. I mean, again, it seems to me that this is an issue of Harris not seriously engaging with the literature before starting writing his own stuff. I mean, he's talking, I have a couple of quotes from one of his essays, which are pretty fantastic. I mean, he says something like that it's a common consensus among, Western thinkers that moral relativism is okay, that genital mutilation is okay. Really? I never heard of this consensus. I mean, this is ridiculous. Yes, there is a certain number of, unfortunately, vocal people who are moral relativists. But to say that that's this, you know, the standard view that Western societies now has adopted, it seems bizarre.
I agree. I think we're, you and I have the same view on this. I think a lot of it does stem from the fact that he's trying to address what is a very deep and nuanced issue without, as you say, first understanding how we got to where we are now.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's move on to Who's That Noisy? Evan, can you play Who's That Noisy from last week?
I absolutely can. Wait, yeah. Here it is.
Yog se sampurna swasthya kaise paaye? Yog se kaise mitaye apni vyadhiyon ko? Aur kaise rahe 100 varsh tak swasth? Yog hai sampurna aarogya ka aadhaar.
That was Sam that Harris. talking about Sam. No, I think we've beaten him up enough tonight. That was, ever heard of Baba Ramdev?
I've heard of Baba Yaga.
I have too, and Baba O'Reilly. If you happen by YouTube, have a look at Baba Ramdev. I mean, sure, not everyone can speak Hindi or whichever dialect he's speaking in these videos, but he has some titles here of some videos that he's made, such as Baba Ramdev, Yoga for Obesity, Baba Ramdev, Yoga for High Blood Pressure, Baba Ramdev, Yoga for Diabetes, Baba Ramdev, Yoga for Physical Elegance, and the ever-popular Baba Ramdev, Yoga for Constipation and Piles.
Exactly. What?
He had me right up until the last one there. So the thing is, yoga, if you just think of it as, if you substitute exercise for yoga, yeah, it will help with obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure, and probably your aesthetics. You know, the piles, I'm not so sure.
Can you believe somebody got this?
Now, when you say yoga for diabetes, meaning this is yoga that it actually causes diabetes? No.
That treats it.
That's not what it means. I see. Oh, that's too bad, because that would have been more original.
Yeah. According to Baba Ramdev, yoga is good for just about anything that ails you. It's on YouTube, though, and someone actually answered this correctly, if you can believe it. And that was our listener, Armit, from Vancouver, who sent in an email and said, no doubt, that's yoga guru Baba Ramdev. He actually met him a couple times in India. So he had the pleasure of meeting him, and therefore he was ready for the Who's That Noisy more than anyone else. So well done, Armit.
What does he win?
Oh,
our admiration.
Mention on the podcast.
Eternal admiration.
Right, and he's
immortalized in the SGU.
The envy of all his friends.
Ah. Boy, you guys are definitely not into material.
All right.
Spiritual wholeness.
On his deathbed, he will receive total consciousness.
So, you know, he's got that going for him.
Which is nice.
What do you got for this week,
this
Evan?
This week, Who's That Noisy? Is as follows. All right, that may not have sounded like much to you.
Really?
But it is something very specific, and I'll give you a hint. For those of you who have been paying attention to your science and technology articles and papers and blogs over the last month to 6 weeks, might be able to figure out what that was. So
it relates to a recent science news.
Good luck, everyone. We'll talk about it next week.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I ask my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Ready.
Yeah. So ready.
Item number one. New research shows that while married men live longer than unmarried men, women do not gain this benefit from being married. Item number two, the most extensive genetic analysis to date supports the conclusion that all life on Earth descended from a single common ancestor. And item number three, new observations indicate that much of the missing matter in the universe is not dark matter, but rather a diffuse hot cloud of intergalactic gas made of normal baryonic matter. Massimo, since you are our guest, I'll have you go first.
You want me to pick one, eh?
One of them is false, yeah, so pick the one that's false.
The one that's false is the one about the common ancestor. My reading of the literature is actually quite the opposite, that the more we know about very deep base of the tree of life, the more it doesn't look like a single common ancestor. It looks more like a web. Mm-hmm. So I'd be surprised if somebody all of a sudden has reversed a trend that has been going on for several years. But you never know. The baryonic matter thing also seems actually fairly counter-trendy because in the last few years there's been a lot of talk about dark matter. So that would be surprising as well, actually, if it were true. But I'm farther away from that field of research, so I'm not as confident on that one. As far as the first one is concerned, I'm not surprised. Of course, it doesn't. There's no benefit for women to hang around with men for a long time.
Okay, let's see. Bob, go next.
See, much of the missing matter, not dark. Yeah, I mean, there dark matter has been getting a lot of the news, but there always was this. I always thought that there was also this other missing matter that wasn't necessarily dark matter. I'm not sure how significant it is in terms of percentage. I'm going to go with that one, though. I'm going to say that one is science. The second one, though, most extensive genetic analysis supports the conclusion that all life on Earth descended from a single common ancestor. You know, I'm going to say that one is science. I'm going to agree with that one. And if you look at, you know, you look at the proteins and look at the genetic basis for all life, it's clear that we're all related, and there's no anomaly out there that kind of points the way towards a separate, you know, a separate genesis that's so different from us that if they used, for example, different proteins that other life wouldn't use. So I wanted to say that, yeah, they could have done some huge genetic study that kind of conclusively, you know, analyzed the data and show that all life must be related. So yeah, that one makes sense to me. Something funky, though, about this first one about married men living longer than unmarried men, but women not gaining that benefit, that doesn't sound right to me. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan?
I think the one about women not gaining the benefit from being married is science. I think that the missing matter in the universe, not being dark matter, but rather normal matter, is also science. I think you're right. It was 20 or 24%, I think, of known universe was dark matter, Bob, if I recall. So I'm not too surprised by that. I'm very convinced by what Massimo had to say about all life descending from the single common ancestor. So I am going that route, and I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
That is a tricky one. I was under the impression that it was still considered correct that it was all descended from a common ancestor, but we just didn't have the tools necessary to do like a large scale study on it. And but I can see that we may have those tools now, so I think that one is quite possibly science. I don't know anything really about the missing matter in the universe being actually normal baryonic matter. That's pretty surprising to me if it's true. But the idea that married men live longer than unmarried men, but women don't get the same benefit, that doesn't quite make sense to me, because I was under the impression that all married people live longer because they're more likely to look out for one another and notice when, you know, health problems crop up and things like that, encourage them to see doctors. And that's the sort of thing that seems like it should swing both ways. So I'm going to go ahead and say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Jay, so we have two for married women not getting a benefit from being married and two for the single common ancestor. What do you say?
So I'll be some sort of tiebreaker if I go with one of those two.
Right.
Okay, well, I'll take these in reverse order, which I find interesting.
For whatever reason.
The one about the observations indicate that much of the missing matter in the universe is an intergalactic cloud of gas. I'm surprised that if that is science, that I wouldn't have heard that, that that wouldn't have been a massive news story unless it just came out, like, you know, 2 hours ago. So I'm not sure about that one, but I think that that one makes sense to be the fiction, but I'm really leaning towards the research about men and women and how long they live, whether they're married or unmarried. From my recollection, that men and women both definitely gained years of life significantly. I think men were gaining, like, you know, 10 plus years, and women I think did too. I don't remember the details, but yeah, I think that one's the fake.
Okay, so I guess I'll take these in reverse order since you all agree in number three. New observations indicate that much of the missing matter in the universe is not dark matter, but rather a diffuse hot cloud of intergalactic gas made of normal baryonic matter. And that one is science. Cool. That is...
I thought you were going to say fiction there.
Yeah, would have been just nice, huh? So that's called WIM, Warm Hot Intergalactic Matter.
Steve, when did you read that?
Pretty recently, today. And this was just announced yesterday, actually. It was announced yesterday. This was observations made by the Chandra X-ray Observatory. And this is something that astronomers have been chasing for a while. I mean, they suspect that there's some amount of matter in between the galaxies, leftover remnants from the formation of galaxies, plus other matter seeded into it from galaxies. But it's really hard to see because it's wispy thin. But they were able to use the X-ray telescope to pinpoint it a little bit further, and they found that... yeah, there's actually a significant amount of this stuff. And we've actually reported on some preliminary data for this before. I think, in fact, this is a previous science or fiction. It's really hot. You know, they say warm hot, but it's, you know, warm being 100,000 degrees and hot being up to 10 million degrees. So, and this does explain much of, not all of it, there's still dark matter. Dark matter definitely exists, and this doesn't change that. But this does fill in a huge chunk of the missing matter in the universe, you know, that we knew had to be there because of, you know, the local gravity, for example. So,
So this is a really big deal because the dark matter discussion has been going on for some time. And now when you say there's definitely dark matter left over, well, at this point, a reasonable question would be, really? Or is it that we're missing something else?
Well, I mean, that's true, but no. you could always... dark matter's, so I think there's a common perception that it's an argument from ignorance, that basically there's got to be stuff there, but we don't know what it is, so let's call it dark matter. But we really are beyond that with the dark matter. And first of all, the majority of the evidence for dark matter comes from looking at how galaxies behave, and therefore intergalactic matter wouldn't really impact on that at all, right?
Yeah.
So... you know, it's initially used to explain why the galaxy is rotating as quickly as it is. So obviously intergalactic gas won't affect that. Plus there's also, remember the bullet galaxy where, you know, one galaxy crashed into another one and the normal matter came to a stop but the dark matter went past it and we could see it. We could see the gravitational effect of the dark matter continuing to just move through the other galaxy while the gas clouds basically crashed into each other and came to a halt. So... There is still dark matter. I mean, what it is a mystery, but there is something that's there that we can't see that's having a gravitational effect. And this is really just looking for the intergalactic matter that we knew was there, but we couldn't see.
And there's other lines of evidence even beyond what you mentioned, Steve, that are extremely compelling. So
Right. But this does affect the equation of how, like, we divide up the universe, how much baryonic, how much... energy, how much dark energy, how much dark matter. They didn't give specific figures. I don't think they're at that point yet, but we'll see. You know, how this affects how much stuff, how much different kinds of stuff there is in the universe. So, very interesting. Let's go on to number 2, the most extensive genetic analysis to date supports the conclusion that all life on Earth descended from a single common ancestor. Massimo and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Science.
Really?
Hooray.
It is, yeah. So I was with you, Massimo. That's partly why I included this, although it kind of depends on exactly what you mean by a common ancestor, and also what you think the what the implication is of the horizontal genetic transfer that you're talking about, especially at the base of the tree, and also just that when you get down to like single-celled creatures like bacteria, they horizontally transfer a lot of genetic information from one species to another. It's not so much of the simpler construction of a branching tree, although when you get farther away from the roots, or when you get to more complicated multicellular life, there's more of the linear genetic transfer, and there's less, although not non-zero, horizontal transfer. We can still trade genes. Do you guys know how that happens? How we might, one mammalian species might exchange genes to a completely unrelated mammalian species?
Transposons, for instance.
And viruses, right? So a virus can take a little bit of DNA from us and infect another species and give it to them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so be careful which animals you're hanging out with.
Yeah, right. But with this, so this was an extensive genetic analysis. They looked at, and Bob, you were talking as if you probably read this, did you? Or you just were just that on.
Smart, man. Maybe. Just knows
stuff. They looked at 23 universally conserved proteins, meaning that they exist in every species. They're universally conserved. And they looked at different species from the eukaryotes, from the archaea, and from bacteria. And so the most different, most fundamental parts of the branches of the tree of life, if you will. And they did a very, the kind of computer analysis that you really could only do recently. I mean, computers had to be as powerful as they are just recently to do the kind of analysis that they did. And they basically asked the question, what's the most likely configuration of these proteins? And what they concluded was that all of life on Earth being descended from a single common ancestor population is millions of times more likely than any other possible configuration, that is overwhelmingly the most likely scenario.
So I'm sure this is going to cause the crash of the intelligent design movement.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Yeah. I mean, one of the things
they're just going to give up.
Yeah, just give up, because one of the things that they've actually been saying over the last few years precisely was that when the research was pointing toward a reticulate base for the tree of life, a lot of those people picked up on it and said, see, Darwin was wrong. There is no single common ancestor, which, of course, it's a non sequitur. Doesn't matter what the actual base of the shape of the structure of the tree of life is. But now that they're on record saying that, I think we should send an email to our esteemed colleagues and friends at the Discovery Institute and say, okay, now time to give up.
The Discovery Institute was jumping all over news items and articles, like in the New Scientist, about the webbiness of the tree of life, as if it's incompatible with evolution, which is a non sequitur, as you say. And they were, again, just trying to make the argument that, see, Darwin was wrong with the most simplistic misunderstanding of what the actual science was saying. But this is nice. And actually, in the article, the scientists talk about the fact that, there's webbiness at the base of the tree, but it doesn't matter. Even if you have multiple different species exchanging genes back and forth, essentially they're going to form into one species. And then that even if there were multiple origins, with horizontal transfer also is possible, but the bottom line is it passed at some point through one common ancestor species, which then differentiated into all life on Earth.
Right.
That's what their analysis showed.
That's an important point to make a distinction, however, because so the finding is a most recent common ancestor, single common ancestor, does not imply that life originated only once, because as you just said, it could have been that at some point there was a lot of going back and forth and horizontal gene transfer, and then a bottleneck happened, and then we got one ancestor left. Yeah, that's right.
Yes, that's exactly right. Very good. So which means that new research shows that while married men live longer than unmarried men, women do not gain this benefit from being married, and that is fiction. This was a very subtle, though, twisting of the research on my part. So good for you guys for getting this right. But this was I was hoping I was going to catch people who read the summary of this, because if you read the summary of this, you could very easily get confused, because they kind of give the false impression that women don't gain the advantage from being married. But then they say at the end, men and women who are married both live longer than men and women who are not married. However, here's what this new research showed, that men gain more of a benefit when their wife is younger than they are. And that is a fairly linear relationship that doesn't change. So for
that's where you got it.
So yeah, women when the wife is older than the husband, the husband still benefits, but not as much. And then the younger the wife gets, the more the male benefits in terms of living longer.
Must be all that sex. Right.
Well, that's one hypothesis, the hypersex hypothesis. So they said there's, you know, the leading hypothesis as to why this was the case was, one was the a selection for healthy males, that healthy males were attracted to, or were able to attract, younger women. So they already were destined to live longer. Right,
so it's not a causal connection there, therefore.
Right. Well, the other hypothesis is that younger women would be able to take care of their older husbands better and longer, therefore that contributed to their longevity. So those are the two main factors that they thought. They were younger and better able to take care of them, and there was the healthy male selection bias.
But not just the healthy male selection bias, but also I would think, and maybe it's related and indistinguishable, but the fact that not only were you in better shape initially, but you try to maintain that shape just to, you know, because you feel like you have to really keep somebody that's significantly younger than you. You might have to
work out and
do better. I think that's part of it.
It could be.
Yeah, but then women would get the same benefit.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, here's the thing. So that data existed only for men, and they assumed that it was the same for women. Now there's the new study that compares it to women, and it turns out that women who are married get the most benefit from being married when the husband is the same age as they are. When their husband gets older than they are, the benefit decreases, and surprisingly, when the husband gets younger than they are, it significantly decreases, even much more than being older.
So
women,
wow,
yeah, with the younger men are a drag on. We shouldn't say that. That's where the article sort of gets confusing, because it makes it sound like younger husbands are a detriment, but they're just not as much of a benefit as same aged husbands.
Yes,
right.
So there's still an advantage. There's still an advantage in being married, but not as much, I think.
Not as much. So why does that advantage diminish with the younger age relatively of the husband? And that kind of called into question the hypotheses that they were putting forward to explain sort of the linear relationship with spousal age with men. Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Okay, so this week's quote. Hegel was right when he said that we learn from history, that man could never learn anything from history.
And that, of course, is George Bernard Shaw.
Come on, that's the best you can do.
George Bernard Shaw!
Yeah!
Awesome. That was good. Good job.
There we go.
That was pretty good.
I have a new ringtone for my phone.
That's Maximo Massimo.
I have three announcements, Steve.
Go ahead.
The Granite State Skeptics at Granite State Skeptics.org is having the Granite State Skeptics panel at GraniteCon, May 23rd, Manchester, New Hampshire. GraniteStateSkeptics.org.
Carrie Granite.
I'm also going to be in Arizona at a Skeptics in the Pub in Phoenix, Arizona, at the Rock Bottom Bar. That is on May 22nd at 7 p.m.
Really? Wow.
Hey, getting around, Jay. Massimo, are you going to be at TAM 8 this year?
I certainly will. My first time.
Cool.
I'm really excited about it.
First time, eh? We'll be gentle. Massimo, it's been wonderful having you on the show as a guest rogue.
It was a pleasure, as usual.
Thank you all for joining me.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you,
Steve. It was good to meet you. Welcome.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.